is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Monday, December 9th. Today, in the House Judiciary Committee, lawyers for Democrats and Republicans have been making presentations of the evidence for and against the president in the matter of, you know what it is, twisting U.S. foreign policy for his personal advantage by asking or blackmailing the president of Ukraine for help with discrediting Joe Biden and Democrats involved in the 2016 Clinton campaign. Both sides have been giving detailed and organized presentations of the evidence and how to look at it. So on today's podcast, we'll talk about these presentations of evidence and the political context. We'll play some clips. And there's a separate breaking story related in its way. The release of Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz's report about whether the Russia investigation was begun in a legitimate way. Spoiler alert, mostly yes. Second spoiler alert, Attorney General Barr rejects his own Inspector General's main conclusions. We'll play several excerpts from the hearing now and then talk to a guest familiar with both the topics, Ukraine and Russia. The attorney for the Democrats, Daniel Goldman, organized lots of information from all the past witnesses to build a case that the president's alleged abuse of power went way beyond how anyone might interpret the July 25th phone call, with so many government officials and so much documentary evidence indicating there was a months-long pressure campaign that only intensified in August and September until the whistleblower complaint was released, pushing the whole scheme into public view, and they quickly backed off. Now, in this 90-second clip, Goldman cites a bit of the evidence that I personally find among the very most damning for what happened in the weeks after the July 25th call.
Over the next couple of weeks, Ambassador Sondland and Volker worked with President Trump's aide, Mr. Yermak, to draft a statement for President Zelensky to issue. When the aide proposed a statement that did not include specific references to the investigations that President Trump wanted, the Burisma and Biden investigation and the 2016 election investigation, Mr. Giuliani relayed that that would not be good enough to get a White House meeting. And here you can see a comparison on the left of the original statement drafted by Mr. Yermak, the top aide to President Zelensky, and on the right, a revised statement with Mr. Giuliani's requirements. And on it says, we intend to initiate and complete a transparent and unbiased investigation of all available facts and episodes. And here's the critical difference, including those involving Burisma and the 2016 U.S. elections, which in turn will prevent the recurrence of this problem in the future. The only difference in the statement that Giuliani required and the statement that the Ukrainians had drafted was this reference to the two investigations that President Trump wanted and told President Zelensky about on the July 25th call. Now, ultimately, President Zelensky's administration temporarily shelved this announcement, though efforts to press Ukraine would remain ongoing. By mid-August, Ukraine did not make a public announcement of the investigations that President Trump required, and as a result, no White House meeting was scheduled.
So Giuliani, through Volker and Sondland, specifically required Zelensky's draft statement on corruption to be changed to add Burisma by name and the 2016 election by name. Otherwise, no White House meeting. Those were the only specific items that Giuliani required, the ones that could help the president get reelected. That's why I think it's so significant. Those drafts were exchanged on August 11th and August 13th, respectively. Here's one more from a few weeks later, September 1st. By now, not just the White House meeting, but the security aid were being discussed out in the open with Ukrainian officials. Attorney Goldman is describing language by Trump's handpicked ambassador, Gordon Sondland, about what happened just before Vice President Pence was going to have a few minutes with Zelensky at a conference they were both attending in Poland.
On September 1st, at a pre-briefing with Vice President Pence before he met with President Zelensky, Ambassador Sondland raised the issue of the hold on security assistance. He said, I mentioned to Vice President Pence before the meetings with the Ukrainians that I had concerns of that the delay in aid had become tied to the issue of investigations. Vice President Pence simply nodded in response, expressing neither surprise nor dismay at the linkage between the two. And following Vice President Pence's meeting with President Zelensky, Ambassador Sondland went over to Mr. Yermak again, President Zelensky's top aide, and pulled him aside to explain that the hold on security assistance was also now conditioned on the public announcement of the Burisma Biden and the 2016 election interference investigations. Ambassador Sondland then explained to Ambassador Taylor that he had previously made a mistake in telling Ukrainian officials that only the White House meeting was conditioned on a public announcement of the political investigations beneficial to President Trump. In truth, everything, the White House meeting and the vital security assistance to Ukraine, was now conditioned on the public announcement. President Trump wanted President Zelensky in a public box. A private commitment was not good enough.
So, listeners, there you have two examples, one from August, one from September, of really specific documents or testimony by these various government officials, Trump appointees, about conditioning a meeting and military aid on announcements of investigating the Bidens and people related to the Clinton campaign. Now we'll play two clips of House Republican attorney Steve Castor defending the president today and presenting evidence that he thinks is favorable to him. This first stretch involves a sequence of statements by President Zelensky, who would be the victim of any blackmail scheme, denying that he ever felt he was being shaken down. Attorney Steve Castor.
Since President Trump has declassified and publicly released the call summary 75 days ago, President Zelensky has said publicly and repeatedly that he felt no pressure. He said it on September 25th at the United Nations General Assembly. He said it in an interview published on October 6th. He said it again on October 10th. And most recently, he said it just last week in Time magazine. Other senior Ukrainian officials have also said there was no linkage between a meeting, security assistance, and an investigation. If President Trump was truly orchestrating a pressure campaign to force Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Biden, one would think that Ukraine would have felt some pressure.
So the Republicans are using the lack of any acknowledgement by Zelensky on multiple occasions as an argument that there was no plot. How does that fit in with the evidence of a plot that we heard in the earlier clips? Well, if you were on a jury, you would have to decide. Here's one more from the Republican counsel. He argues there are plausible reasons other than forcing Ukraine to announce investigations of Democrats that the president could have put a hold on the military aid.
The impeachment record also has substantial evidence going to the president's state of mind, undercutting the Democrats' assertion of some malicious intent. Witnesses testified that President Trump has a deeply rooted, genuine, and reasonable skepticism of Ukraine stemming from its history of corruption. President Trump is skeptical of U.S. taxpayer-funded foreign assistance and believes that our allies should share more of the burden of Ukraine's defense. Ukrainian politicians openly spoke out against President Trump during the 2016 election. These events bear directly on the president's state of mind. President Zelensky had run on an anti-corruption platform, but he was an untried politician with a relationship to a controversial Ukrainian oligarch.
Republican attorney Steve Castor. So there you have two Democratic bites and two Republican bites. My hope is that they are fairly representative of how they each have argued today. But of course, there has been so much more than that hour after hour. With me now, Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News and co-author of the book, Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. Hi, Michael. Thanks for coming on again.
Hey, good to be with you.
Let's go through the clips we heard just there briefly. And again, with so much evidence out there, these don't represent everything. But what's your take on the significance to the factual record of the way Giuliani changed the draft statement from Zelensky's office on August 13th to specifically add language about Burisma, meaning the Bidens, and 2016.
Yeah, that's pretty strong evidence that that's what this was about, investigating the Bidens and 2016 election interference. I don't think there's much doubt about that. It's very odd because the House Republicans are sort of the hardliners here in trying to defend the president on every step of the way and trying to cast doubt about what I think most people would think is a pretty compelling case made by the Democrats. But in an odd way, I don't think that's what the debate is really about. And when it gets to the Senate, and this is going to get to the Senate in a trial, I don't think, you know, these details will certainly be key to the presentation of evidence. They'll certainly be key to the articles of impeachment drafted. But the real question is going to be, does this rise to the level of impeaching and removing the president in an election year? And I think that's where the Democrats have run into a pretty stone wall in terms of public opinion. The needle hasn't moved in the polls. If you look at it, if anything, support for impeachment seems to have faded a little bit. And so therefore, when this gets to the Senate, I think the question is going to be, okay, you've made a case, the president acted in ways that were clearly improper, clearly indefensible here, but does that mean he should be removed from office?
Yeah, and I see your colleagues at Yahoo News have a new poll over the last few days showing the evidence is getting through to a meaningful degree. In other words, over 50% of Americans say, yeah, they do think the president was acting in his private interest against the national interest here, versus only 30-something percent who don't think that. And yet that doesn't change the political math enough.
Well, look at that poll, you know, go through the rest of the numbers. When you get to, does it add up to removal from office, it's 47-45. So less than half the country is with the Democrats on this. And that's when you're going into impeachment. Now, look, this is the last chance that the Democrats have really to lay out the evidence and perhaps, build some public support for what they're trying to do. And I thought that Barry Burke did a very good job of cross-examining Steve Castor, the Republican counsel, about some of the gaps in the Republican minority report and bringing out. He did it in an adversarial way that I'm not sure how much that sort of wins over people in the middle. We'll see. But certainly, as a courtroom matter, I thought it was a very good cross examination that scored some points. But remember, if we're analogizing this to a courtroom trial, a jury has to be unanimous to convict somebody, right? And I don't think you can strike all Republicans from a jury pool. I don't think that would pass constitutional muster. So I think that gives you some idea of just how difficult the case is for the Democrats at this point.
Let's get to the Justice Department Inspector General's report, this other big story today about the origins of the Russia investigation. And it's one of the reasons we wanted you for today. You wrote the book Russian Roulette about the Russia investigation. Remind us of the background. Why did the Justice Department launch this investigation?
Well, look, obviously, the opening and conduct of Crossfire Hurricane was going to come under scrutiny under any circumstances. It was an extraordinary investigation.
Crossfire Hurricane was the FBI's code for the Russia investigation.
Right. And it was inevitable, I think, that there would be some internal reviews. It is a very rare, if not unprecedented, for the FBI to launch a full-fledged investigation, counterintelligence investigation into a major party's political campaign. So this report by Michael Horowitz is really, and I'm just started going through it, and there's, it's something like 500 pages. So there's it's a wealth of new details that we are learning today about the Russia investigation. And there's two big headlines. One is, as for the claims that That the President Trump and his allies have made, that this was a political witch hunt that was based on political bias by people inside the FBI who had a hostility to then candidate Trump. The IG concludes it could find no evidence of that, that each of the FBI's steps were adequately predicated with a proviso that to launch an investigation of this kind, the bar is pretty low. You don't have to prove it's not even probable cause to get the warrant to open up the investigation itself. And so that in that sense, some of the conspiracy theories that have been actively pushed on Fox News and by the president himself and his allies like Devin Nunes are not going to hold up with the contents of this report. That said, there is a lot of damning stuff in here when you go through it about the Bureau's use of that Steele dossier. The IG finds that essentially none of its specific allegations relating to the Trump campaign and Russia were corroborated. And yet the FBI continued to use the information from Steele in its submissions to the federal, to the FISA court. That was pretty striking when I read through it. It also raises questions about the sourcing of Steele's claims, suggesting, he quotes Steele himself saying that one of his key sources was a boaster who may not have been completely reliable when the FBI tracked down some of the one of the subsources, that subsource contradicted some of what was in the Steele dossier, raising questions about the reliability of the document. So from the perspective of Republicans, they've been handed a lot of new ammunition here that they're going to be able to use to certainly distract from the Ukraine allegations at this point.
Do you have a sense yet of how the material from the Steele dossier, if none of it was corroborated and yet they continued to use it as a justification for getting the court to sign off on surveillance, how that happened? Because you're telling me that the inspector general also concluded that there was no political bias, there was no agenda to get Trump in these errors. So do you have a sense yet? And I realize you said this is just out and it's 500 pages long. How this happened?
It is a 500-page report and I'm just going through it. But in just from reading the executive summary, it does appear that information... And look, you find this whenever you put the microscope under anything in the government or in corporate America where there are screw-ups left and right. And in this case, it appears that some of the information that raised questions about the credibility of what Steele had alleged was not being passed along to higher-ups who had to affirm the credibility of the FBI's warrant. And I think it's going to raise a lot of questions as to why not. We do know that at least one FBI lawyer, Michael Horowitz, the IG, does make a criminal referral for at least one FBI lawyer who Horowitz found had withheld information from higher ups in the FBI.
And that will bring us back in a certain way to one final clip from today's Judiciary Committee hearing that I also want to get in. This is Ranking Republican Doug Collins questioning Democratic Attorney Daniel Goldman about who ordered the recent subpoenas for another kind of surveillance, obtaining the phone records recently that indicated some of the numbers that Rudy Giuliani and Congressman Devin Nunes were calling Ranking Republican Doug Collins.
You're not answering the question. And every member of the media, everybody here, when you start going into the decorum of this house, when you start looking at members' telephone numbers, you start looking at reporters' telephone numbers, which they ought to be scared about, you took a subpoena for four. And then you decided to play match game. You found numbers that you thought were like, some of them actually didn't exist because they claimed that they were for the White House budget office, and they were not. So we're throwing stories out there because nobody was out there acting. So I go back to my question. Are you going to go on record in front of everybody here today and say that you will not tell who ordered this? You or Mr. Goldman? Mr. Goldman, you or Mr. Schiff?
I am going to go on record and tell you that I'm not going to reveal how we conducted this investigation.
And that's the problem we have with this entire thing. Mr. Schiff said behind closed doors.
I can tell you what the importance is.
I'm done with you for right now. We're done. God. You're not answering the question. You're not being honest about this answer because you know who it is. You're just not answering.
So we have Democrats investigating what the president did and Republicans trying to change the focus to how both Democrats and in the Steele case, law enforcement have conducted their investigations. How do you understand the subpoenas issue?
Well, the committee appears to have subpoenaed AT&T, the phone company, and I think Verizon as well, to get these phone records. I got to say, I don't know that Goldman scores many points for not answering that question by Collins. It seems to me, as the committee counsel, that was a perfectly appropriate question to ask, and I can't understand his reasons for not answering it. It's pretty straightforward, I would think, that as part of the investigation, given the prominent role that Rudy Giuliani had, that the committee would want to look at his phone records. He is the president's lawyer, so, you know, there is some sensitivity there. But given that Giuliani was so central to what the committee was investigating, I would think Goldman should have been straightforward and said just what I said. Hey, this guy is right in the middle of it. We're trying to figure out who he had contacts with, who he didn't. And so we got his phone records. And as it turned out, they showed phone conversations with Devin Nunes, the ranking Republican on the committee, and a journalist, John Solomon. Whether the committee had to publish those, you know, without further information about what they added up to or meant or what the justification for it was, is another question that I think could have been a good follow-up. But, the fact that they got that they sought the phone records, why shouldn't Goldman have answered that question?
And on they go. Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News and co-author of the book Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. Michael, thank you so much.
Sure, anytime.
We've been inviting listeners who think President Trump should be removed from office to write their own article of impeachment and record it on our voicemail the last few weeks. Now we'll flip the script. For those of you who think Trump should not be impeached, it's your turn. Write out a short but organized argument against removing him from office. To see how to submit it, you can go to the website impeachmentpodcast.org, impeachmentpodcast.org, and click on the tab that says Articles of Impeachment, then record it using the online recorder. Or if you want to bypass all that, you can just write your organized argument and call it into this voicemail line, 844-745-8255, and leave a voicemail, 844-745-8255, or go to impeachmentpodcast.org. We'll play some of them on the podcast. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. Listeners, if you're hearing this before 8 p.m. Eastern Time Monday night, I invite you to join me for a live call-in at 8 p.m. Eastern on the events of today. That's on WNYC Radio in New York or WNYC.org from anywhere on Earth. See you tomorrow.